This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network.
TalkSport, powered by fans.
Hello and welcome to the Back of the Nest Review Show. My name is Chris Hamling and I'm your host as we look back on Palace's 2-0 defeat against champions Manchester City. It was a decent display from Roy Hodgson's men, but ultimately the visitors proved too strong for the Eagles to continue their strong run of results. We'll be getting into the detail in just a moment and also looking at some of the other key points from the week.
No paywall, no subscription.
Back of the Nest.
Fan-created podcasts, videos and articles.
Free forever.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. So the only thing left to say is, you in? Order now on the McDonald's app. You can also get reward points delivered too. So the ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus. Rewards registration required. Points only on menu items. Delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com. Right, let's introduce you to my wonderful panel. And I've given you the adjective of wonderful in advance. If you could perform wonderfully, that would be really, really helpful. First up, DR Kernas.
Hello.
Hello. It is good to hear from you, DR. It's been a while.
It is. I'm going to ask you a question straight away. Can you rob yourself? No, I'm not saying you in particular, but like, can someone rob themselves?
I feel you should have enunciated a bit better in there, because it did sound a little bit like you said, can you rub yourself? And
oh, sorry. I was drinking water and you came straight away to me.
Yeah, so rob, as in steal from yourself.
Yep.
I'll be honest with you. I mean, you asked this question pre-show, and I'm kind of baffled. What do you think? Can you steal from yourself?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you do with intent of I'm going to steal from myself and give it to someone else, then doesn't that class as robbing yourself?
So you're Robin Hooding yourself. You're stealing from yourself, the rich, and giving to the poor. Other people.
Well, you complicated the word complicate.
So, I mean, what to do with that? I'm going to have to ask Mike and Chris. Mike, start with you. The concept of stealing from yourself, how do you feel about that?
There's definitely been nights where I've woke up the next morning and I drunk me has tea-leafed some serious cash out of normal me's bank account. So I suppose I've robbed me then. But otherwise, I'd just put it down to another DR-ism.
I think you can, for exactly the same reason that Mike's just said, but also added to that, I kind of lived that life yesterday because, the Pawsons was particularly enriched through my contributions at the bar yesterday. I definitely took out at least 50 quid. And I now have no money at all left at the end of that night. So it was a good night, but I've also been absolutely broken at the time of recording. Utterly useless.
Yeah. Yeah, you're not sounding too great, but if there's any way of lifting you, it's having to record a podcast whilst hungover. Seeing as we're talking to you, obviously, this is Chris Clark. And hello, Chris.
Yeah, hello, Chris. Bit broken, as we said, but... Oh. Really raring to go for the show.
You sound raring to go. I mean, something in your voice suggests that that's a lie, but we won't dwell on it. Mike Scott.
Yeah, I didn't stay out quite as late as Chris did, but I joined him at the Paulsons after a few drinks at the Glazers and a couple in the Cronks during the game. And my daughter woke me up at 5:30 this morning, so... I blame Chris for how I felt for about the first 6 hours of the day today.
Sorry, mate.
Excellent stuff. Well, you're absolutely right to ask how I'm feeling after doing the Palace for Life marathon last week.
Was it? Oh, God, yeah. Sorry.
It was emotional, guys. I mean, this year, obviously there's a load of us did it last year. This year, not quite so many. me and Si were the only people that made it. But noticeably, I had a very different experience this year because, do you know what? Apparently, well, in fact, in practice, it makes a huge difference if you actually train and prepare yourself and follow the sort of guidelines that they give you instead of reading them afterwards, wondering why things hurt so much. So,
can't relate. I feel like if you train, and you took drugs as well.
I took 3 paracetamol at the lunch break.
That's drugs. You cheated. So, I mean, you haven't completed it full on. If you done it without taking drugs, I mean, training is fair. But yeah, you took drugs. And last year, you basically made up for last year. So, if you know what I mean.
So I have to do it again next year without taking any paracetamol at all.
And then, you completed then. Because you had to make up for last year by doing it this year. If you do it next year, then you're like, yes, I've completed it.
Well, fair enough. Look, thank you to everyone who sponsored, by the way. Really appreciated. And you can still do so if you go on to justgiving.com, search for Back of the Nest 2019, and you'll see we're still fundraising there. But it made a big difference. And obviously, want to give a quick shout out to Si Pizzi as well, who was great company walking around the place. He's actually run marathons before, and I felt pretty good for the fact that I sort of kept up with him the whole time. And, you know, and he himself pointed out it was the longest he'd ever exercised for. And it's quite good to have that sort of context that, you know, running a marathon is obviously extremely tough, and I don't think something I could do. But it was for different reasons. It's seemingly equally tough to walk one. So, excellent stuff. Anyway, I won't dwell any more on that. Obviously, we're here to talk about Palace's game against Manchester City and a variety of other things. And included in that variety of other things, we've also got the Benteke and Tompkins contract extensions to talk about. Just before we do that, obviously, not all of you are on social media. So if you do want to get in touch with the show and you're not using Twitter, Instagram or Facebook or anything like that, you can email us directly at hi@backofthenest.com. Not this week, but usually we'll be releasing a Your View podcast on a Tuesday when we've got loads of your audio clips. We're a bit pushed for time this week, so I don't think that'll happen. And of course, keep your iTunes reviews coming or whatever podcast app that you happen to use. Give us 5 stars. It means an awful lot to us, but not only that, it really does help share the show with a number of different people. With lots of different people, they get to see more, they see the recommendations, much more likely to download it, and then we feel better because it pushes us even further up the charts, which Mikey watches like a hawk. Anyway, everybody, let's talk about the fact that it was announced this week that, well, I think most people were very comfortable with James Tompkins getting a contract extension. Been an absolutely fantastic signing. We'll talk about him in just a moment. But I suppose probably the headline news was the extension on a contract for Christian Benteke, given his form over the last couple of seasons, going into this season as well. So I can give my views in just a minute, but I think, Mike, this is a topic you started, so wondering what your personal views on it are.
Well, it's an interesting one because I think first, something that they're not going to give away, they're going to keep close to their chest, is what the conditions are for this extension. You'd have to assume with an extension that it would be the same conditions as the current rest of his contract, which is worrying for me. Not really because it feels like wasted money. You know, it's not my money. And when people sort of go really personal about it, I find it strange because I think, well, this is the club's money and they spend it how they see fit. But I think what worries me is if they've done it in order to ship him on, it was obvious in the summer that player power had the impact of not getting rid of him when perhaps the club wanted to. Now, I've heard differing stories on this. I've heard that the club weren't happy with the offers, the 15 million from China, and they didn't feel like it was enough. But if they were, and he said, I'm not going, by giving an extension, that seems odd because that's going to put him another 12 months of being able to say whether he goes or not. Now, whether that's an issue, I don't know. Does or whether that means we're not going to sign another striker because we've got Benteke, I don't know. But it is odd. And until we sort of find out more of the details about how the extension worked, I sort of reserve judgment to an extent.
I think the Benteke one, of course, people are going to be going at it because he hasn't performed over the last two seasons. But you never want to lose a player on a free. And I don't see a market for him in England. I don't see someone from England trying to come and purchase Benteke off us because they've seen him over the last few years and now he's built up a negative reputation. But abroad, and I'm saying, when I say abroad, especially Turkey, if you say Benteke, people are still like, oh, Christian Benteke. He's still got this reputation of being a classy player. And I feel like that'll play a part in it. I still think that he's got a bit of value. And I know that sounds crazy, but you saw in the summer the reported China bid, for example, 15 million. Someone still came for 15 million for Benteke. And it's another season. And this is a massive time for Benteke to actually prove himself because I've personally lost hope in him. I don't see a way back for him at Palace, but he's got another season. And if it don't work out, we'll try selling him on. And I think we can still do that.
Well, he's 28, must be coming up to 29. And I think the fact he still holds value is because people remember the player he was before the last couple of years. And it does make logical sense that a team or a manager might look at him and say, actually, it'll suit Art the way we play so much better. We'll provide such better service. He won't have to do all the running around. He's exactly what we want. And they will have faith that he is going to recover that goal scoring touch, recover that confidence. You know, he still obviously played for Belgium at the international break and scored a decent goal from actually outside the box, if I remember correctly. So there's obviously still faith in that there's ability there. But, you know, mentally, I think that's the question. And I'm with Mike on this. I don't really put any value in people being abusive about it. It's pretty obvious that the club aren't giving him a contract because he's earned it through how he's playing. I think that goes out the window. It's clearly a means of protecting the value of the player because there must be interest in him for that to happen. But I think the sort of other thing I would mention is perhaps what if we let him go on a free and the worst happens and we have our targets in the transfer window and we fail miserably to get them in because that's happened, right? And we end up with no new strikers and no Benteke, things get even worse. And I think that's a distinct possibility as well. And if he's there willing to accept an additional year, and I suggest probably willing to accept a reasonable pay cut, I don't think we've done anything other than try to protect the value of a player that there is a market for.
Look, I'll use this as an example. When we sent Sørloth on loan to Trabzonspor, people actually greeted him at the airport. I mean, he couldn't kick a ball for us. And then when Falcao went to Turkey, 50,000 people went to the open ceremony. I still have a feeling that Benteke, he's better than Sørloth, but I don't think he's got a reputation such as Falcao. He'll still attract 25,000 people to his open ceremony. He's like, is that kind of player? And I mean, age doesn't matter. In countries, even if you look at the MLS, for example, it's like, From the previous reputation, that's what people really care about and that's what's been on people's head. People don't look at Christian Benteke right now from abroad and say, oh, he's only scored how many goals in 2 years. They don't see that. They still think about the times at Aston Villa. So that's why I feel like it's a good move from the club.
He's 28 years old, just answering and confirming what you said, Hambo. He turns 29 in December. I think there's still potentially a way back for him, you know, to start games and score goals. Now, that may be controversial. There are lots of people who have a continuing downer on him and indeed probably a justified lack of faith because he hasn't delivered over the last couple of years. On the other hand, I thought, you know, I mean, we are obviously reviewing the game as well today, and I thought he had a really good headed chance that he took really well, and it was a good save that stopped that going in. So, you know, I think there's a way back for him. I'm happy he signed the extension, and I don't think it's just about protecting the value. At the moment, we haven't got someone who offers what he offers, and, you know, other than him. So I'd say we keep him, and it's the right thing to do.
I'm not sure it's worth discussing whether he's going to come good anymore. I mean, I heard a talk of it on a certain other Palace pod, you know, saying he probably will come good. I mean, you wouldn't make a business decision based on something that's provided no financial reward for the best part of 3 years. So I'm sure he will come good. I'm sure he will score a goal for someone, but I mean, the chances are he's not going to suddenly go back to how he was. He might score the odd goal because, you know, he is a striker. The odds are stacked in favour of him scoring at some point. But I don't think that's part of the argument in this. And when people are saying, oh, we shouldn't have given him extension because he's useless, Hambo's totally right. That just doesn't come into it. It's literally holding together his value and holding together the fact that we actually have, what, three strikers, one of which is injured the whole time. So we don't really have any options unless we pull in one out of the under-23s.
Well, exactly. And you know, with the greatest respect to the under-23s, there's nobody pulling up trees and pushing for a place in terms of being a forward who can lead the line and perhaps most importantly, lead the line in the way that the Roy Hodgson method requires. And I think that perhaps is the biggest challenge of all. You know, Benteke doesn't really suit the way that Roy wants to play, and it's noticeable that that isn't going to change. It's the player that's had to adapt, not the system, and that's been across the board, really. It's not just about Christian Benteke. Lots of other players have had to adapt, and take Andros Townsend, who finds himself out of the team right now for that precise reason. But I think, you know, we can sort of talk around in circles about it. I think the bottom line is it's completely understandable to have a negative reaction to a player who has been consistently underperforming for a long period of time being kept at the club. And I know certainly in some people's minds, they'll be thinking back to contracts awarded to players who simply weren't going to play. You know, Johnny Williams, Paddy McCarthy, if you go back a little while, even, I guess, Julian Speroni to a point, although that personally, I believe that's sacrilege, but it's been mentioned before. And you just think, you know, I suppose when you're looking at the club saying, well, not necessarily even openly saying, you're looking at the suspicion that we don't have huge amounts of money to fling around in the direction of players, it does kind of feel like a bit of a waste to put resources into you know, people who aren't performing. And whatever Benteke's taken as a contract, you could certainly argue it's too much when you look at it, even over the course of the additional year. You know, it's probably a pretty large sum of money, but it's just dwarfed by the amount of money it takes to replace him with even an average striker. And even look at the bargain in Jordan Ayew. That's still, in terms of contract and transfer fee, it's still a large sum of money and probably way in excess of what Benteke costs for a year as well. But anyway, that's more than enough. I feel a little bit disrespectful just to sort of glance in Tompkins' directions and say, yep, contract deserved, but that's really all you can say about it. He's been great for us. Unfortunate that he's been injured of late, but back to fitness and played a fairly decent spell in the game as well. So glad we're keeping him about. Glad he was willing to sign the contract and stay with the club, and nothing positive things to say about that. So let's just delve straight into the game, and we're going to start off really with a sort of an assessment of the game, which I kind of understand, and it's perhaps been in keeping with some of the more negative views that we've put forward on this show. But I think it's a good starting off point. So there's a couple of comments. It starts with Eastern Eagle on Twitter, who referred to the performance as an unimaginative, dull surrender. He said, at least have a go, or what's the point? Roy is completely in awe of Pep, sets the team up with zero belief or confidence. Wilf is drained of ambition or threat. All other flair players watching. Seriously disappointing all round. Rob Palmer backed that up with saying, absolutely agree, gave Man City too much respect, sat far too deep. Have we learned nothing from Norwich and Wolves in recent weeks? You've got to get at them. break up their rhythm. Give David Silva or De Bruyne a time and they'll punish you. Zaha is not on form.
I am so confused, like, really. I respect other people's views, of course. But, I mean, last year when we went to play City at the Etihad, did we go and get a result by going and attacking them and pushing forward? No, we didn't. We sat back, we observed the pressure, and then we hit them on a counter-attack. And we decided to go with the same approach because, as you saw with the second goal against us from City, when we did open up, they've got so much class that they'll just destroy you. So I don't understand where people are, or how people are criticizing the setup. I mean, end of the day, yeah, we are sixth, but it's because we've played smart and not expressive football, because that's our strength right now. And going into City and asking the team to go and push forward and attack City and open up space at the back, I think you would have been looking at scoreline more to 5-6-0 rather than 2-0. The downside to this performance wasn't the setup. It was the fact that we conceded in the first half. If it stayed on like that, if we went into the second half 0-0, I feel like the game would have opened up a bit more and would have had more chances. But I mean, you look at the two sides, City's bench is better than our starting 11. So I don't understand the criticism.
Dale, did you just describe it as observing the pressure?
I don't even know. I might.
Okay. I guess it probably, that is true in a way. But yeah, absorbing the pressure is definitely what we did. I just want to take issue. I mean, I kind of understand the point, and I think a lot of people felt it in the heat of the moment, especially when the second one went in, that was kind of what happened. But by the end of the game, got my head around it. I think a lot of people around me got their heads around it, and 2-0 Man City is certainly, there's no shame in that. But this sort of talk of all the flair players being on the bench, I mean, what defines a flair player? It's an odd one. I would describe Joel Ward as having flair because he has excellent hair. I'm not sure. I don't think we could have had any more. I assume you're referring to Camarasa and Mayer. I'm not sure we could have any more flair players on the pitch because simply they're a really, really good team. So you need a lot of defensive-minded players. And that's not to say that those defensive-minded players are not flair players. There was a ball yesterday, and unless you saw it, I'm not even sure it came on the TV, but there was a flick over from the ball was about to go off for a throw-in, and I think it was Joel Ward just hooked the ball over to the left-hand side of the pitch. I don't know if anyone remembers it. And it was an amazing bit of skill. Yep. And that to me is flair. They're solid, dependable Hodgson-style players, but it just seems a bit harsh to describe them as non-flair players. Maybe I'm just splitting hairs, but...
I know exactly what you're talking about. I think, you know, to address that point first, you know, firstly, if you're talking about flair players, you're talking about, I think we're talking about people with that sort of spark or creativity to do something a little bit out of the ordinary, the whole create something out of nothing cliche kind of thing. But, you know, most people are talking about technical skill over sort of functionality. So first of all, playing Man City, when you're a club our size and the type of players that we have, and certainly the type of manager that we have who does value functionality over flair, let's face it, and to good effect. That's not necessarily a criticism. You shouldn't really be, if we line up with a whole bunch of flair players in inverted commas. I was doing the inverted commas, but again, you can't see it, can you? Because it's an hour or medium. So anyway, I just think you know you're asking for trouble, really, because you know, you get the situation where we've got too many people up the pitch, not necessarily 100% willing to chase back and do the dirty work. And if you don't do that against Man City, you lose the game, pure and simple. However, there, as you've kind of acknowledged, Mike, that there is a point in there that is valid, and you're always going to feel when you've effectively just surrendered possession to the opposition, said, come at me, and they've successfully beaten you. I think DR mentioned it, it's almost perfect if you get in at 0-0 at half time, and we so nearly did that, and that's why it's disappointing. It's because you could argue that the warning signs were there and how we were going to concede that goal, but you know, I thought that myself when we conceded the goals the way that we did, which we'll talk about. You know, Roy had even identified before the game, he was asked, you know, what do you think about the fact that Manchester City are having to play midfielders at centre-back? And he basically said, and rightly so, it doesn't really matter because, you know, their centre-backs effectively aren't going to be under that much pressure and their full-backs will be pushing right up the pitch and will be spending most of the time without the ball defending. And when he mentioned the full-backs being high up the pitch, I think what he was getting at is that we'd accepted that somewhere in the way that Man City play and the way that we have to defend, we're going to have to give something. So either we let them have that overlap, or we end up having to get all of our players tracking back, apart from Jordan Ayew standing up the pitch on his own, which completely negates us as any kind of attacking force. So I think he basically went out with a game plan of keeping us as narrow as possible and actually letting them cross the ball in, just ensuring that we were set up properly to deal with that. It's just unfortunate that there was the one occasion when the ball came in from Silva from the one side where we didn't quite do enough to put pressure on, and it was too easy a ball in and we ended up conceding. So I think it's very, very difficult to say that, oh, we should have had a go. Yes, we absolutely did have a go in the second half, and it you know, attack sometimes is as good a form of defence as anything, but I can't agree that we gave them too much respect. And I think pointing at other games where teams like Norwich and Wolves did go for them a little bit, I think it's just as valid for DR to point out how we played them at the Etihad last season and what we did there as to look at those two games. So I've gone on a bit of a rant there, and Chris, you haven't said anything yet, but you know, how do you feel about that? Do you feel that there is a point to be made there? Do you kind of wish that we'd had more of a go?
Frankly, no. But I think it's a very valid point. I understand the frustration, but if this had ended 0-0, or if we'd ended up, you know, jamming a 1-0 win, people would be hailing Hodgson the technical genius. And what actually happened there was that we had a good game plan. It was going really quite well, in my opinion. And then the thing is that if you're going to keep it tight and try and stop them scoring, you actually need to successfully do that. It's a really obvious, facile comment, but it's true. If you end up accidentally conceding, you know, late in a half from a sucker punch, and then you do it again, then you've made your job so much harder. And, you know, there never really was much of a path back from that. We had to be flawless, and we weren't quite. I don't think there's any shame in that. It was a fairly solid, good performance in the first half, with the exception of the mistakes, which we'll come to when we analyse them in detail. But I'm not massively crushed by it. It was pretty much what I expected, which was that we'd give it a damn good go and maybe it'd work, and it didn't quite. But okay, on to the next game, really.
As simple as this might sound, is going into the game, what we needed was everyone staying focused for the entirety of the 90 minutes, all 11 players on the pitch. And I think the one downside is that really didn't happen. I feel like, as Chris said, before the first goal, everything was nice and we were defending well. But I know we're going to talk about the first goal in a minute, but the first goal was due to a mistake. And that's what I was on about before the game, whereas you can't make that one mistake against City. You might be able to afford that against a team like Wolves and Norwich, but you can't afford that against City. And that's what really caused it. I don't think it was tactics, but it was more individual errors that led to this result.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And we'll talk about the goal now. So obviously, as mentioned before, we'd allowed Man City to have the overlap with the fullbacks on a regular basis. We'd allowed them that little bit of space out wide without panicking about it. But I just lost that little bit of shape a little bit. Ball got pushed out to the right-hand side, our left. And you just had that little bit of moment, because it's Fernandinho who's pushing forward with the ball initially. And Ayew's tracking back with him. And it's Jeffrey Schlupp who doesn't quite know what to do there, because he's watching Cancelo and realising that he's not making a move to overlap, so he doesn't stand too close to him. But then there's also Silva behind him, and what he hasn't seen is that PVA has been occupied with marking De Bruyne. So really what he needs to do there is sort of get his head up, look at where the spare man is, and the spare man, unfortunately, is Bernardo Silva. But instead, Schlupp gets sort of drawn towards the ball because Ayew's still tracking back but not getting a foot in, and he kind of just inches towards the ball, and it's just too slow. He's not been decisive with anything that he's done, and to me, that's the individual error. Because by the time the ball goes out to Silva, you know, Schlupper's marking nobody. He's in no man's man. PVA's suddenly got De Bruyne and Bernardo Silva to mark. So by the time he's pointed at someone else to come in and pick up De Bruyne, Bernardo Silva's already put the cross in and it's too late. But we're very, very unlucky as well, because obviously, you know, Gabriel Jesus misses the header, comes off of his shoulder, and then it goes in off the post. And very, very disappointing from my perspective when you actually analyse the goal. Because when I saw it, first of all, I just thought inevitability, they're putting crosses in, one of those crosses eventually going to find its target. But for me, it's very preventable if people are switched on.
Yeah, but I wouldn't only focus on Jeffrey Schlupp. I mean, Joel Wood, that was his man. James Tompkins, he had another City player to mark, and then Joel Wood was on Gabriel Jesus, but he was sitting too far back and he just lost him. So, I mean, if we're to blame Jeffrey Schlupp, I feel like Woody deserves the same amount of blame as well, because, all right, the ball did go in the box, but if Woody did pick up his man, then he wouldn't have had an open header. So I feel like it was a combination of errors, and I wouldn't blame it on one person in particular.
I mean, I've definitely come across as a Joel Ward fanboy on this pod, I know that, but I'm not sure I can totally blame him. There always is going to be the odd time in the game where the defender loses the striker when they're that good. And it pains me to say that he's good, because off his celebration of the goal, goading the lower Holmesdale, he is a little twat. He is an absolute twat, but he is a very good striker. He's going to lose his defender. And when you're talking about a £400,000 defender as well, it's going to happen occasionally. It's Man City. But I sort of veer towards Hambo's point that it was preventable in the first place. And this kind of leads back to the, well, flair players are not going to help you. Because it's an odd thing to say, but at times, Jeffrey Schlupp is a bit of a luxury player. We've discussed it before. He doesn't quite do the legwork that you'd get from Andros. So I know he's versatile, etc., but there are things he's not so good at. And if he's got the same problems that PVA's got, you are going to get balls in that maybe wouldn't have come in. So it's a difficult one. It was a depressing one to see. It was a bad time in the game, just, you know, 39 minutes. It cleaned out the crowd. Everyone went absolutely silent, even the HF. It was a tough one to swallow, but Man City have done that against better teams than us.
What's going on here with the Jeffrey Schlupp slander? I mean, before the first goal was conceded, he done a pretty well job covering for Patrick Van Aanholt, and so did Wilfried Zaha. And I know we'll talk about Wilf later on in the game, but you can't put all the blame on Jeffrey Schlupp. I just can't buy it, because before we conceded, as I'm saying, he was good. And
it's not always about blame, though. It's about the fact that sometimes you've got players that are less good than the players you're playing against. And I think that's one of those goals. It was annoying. The ball came off his shoulder. If it had come off his head, you know, maybe Hennessy would have saved it. You're splitting hairs when you talk about this kind of thing, but that's what we're here to do on a pod. I mean, I don't think anyone's upset that goal went in or that we lost 2-0. But I don't think you can just blame Ward. That's a bit like watching the last 2 seconds of the goal, you know?
Yeah, and to sort of make the point, how can I say this? First of all, I would challenge DR's point that Jeffrey Schlupp had done well up to that point. I think when Roy Hodgson actually subbed him on 55 minutes, I think that tells you realistically what kind of a game he was having. I thought he was awful. But, you know, it's clear from anyone who listens to this pod on a regular basis, I'm not a big fan. I've actually been quite, I praised him quite a lot in the role where he's been playing as part of the front three, because I don't think it matters quite so much where he has, shall I say, those sort of moments of where he lacks intensity in doing either going defending or going forward. It's interesting because Roy's the manager who values people who are focused and do carry out the instructions perfectly. And it's weird. I've never really seen the correlation between that and Jeffrey Schlupp that he does. But he's been very vocal about the fact that he feels, you know, Schlupp is an underrated player. So it must be him who's correct rather than myself. But I see I just see a player who, unfortunately, at key moments, does lack the intensity of defending. If I could maybe give an example in that game, and we are talking about such fine margins as Mike is getting at, we are talking about micro analysis here. But if you look when Wilf had the opportunity to break down the right in the first half and he was outpaced by Fernandinho, that was because Fernandinho broke his neck to get back, absolutely sprinted at top speed. You know, if Wilf had got to the ball first and turned him, Fernandinho would have run out the ground. It was that he was running that quick. And that kind of dedication, and Sterling did it as well on Wilf in the later in the first half, check running back as well, just absolutely giving it everything. And unfortunately, whenever I happen to see a moment of Jeff defending, as an example, he has this tendency to lightly jog towards players, and you just want to see sometimes an intensity. Now, it's not just him; plenty of our players do that, because the way that we defend, the way that we operate, it's all about zones and positioning and space between players. So it is a symptom of how we play as much as it is a symptom of the player. But, you know, I just have this feeling that every time we seem to analyse a goal, there seems to be a lack of closing down from a particular player. And I'm going to try to avoid mentioning him every week, because it will sound like it's a complete witch hunt. So, and I know what happens if I turn it into a witch hunt. Chris, you're going to get particularly upset, aren't you? Any comments to make?
I am going to come in on this. Yeah, I don't think that you can really fairly blame Schlupp for this incident. You know, I mean, acknowledge the point that he, you know, should have, you know, maybe done a couple of things differently earlier on in that move. But ultimately, if the defensive players are in the correct positions, then that goal doesn't happen. Watching it back, very, as you've said before, it's, you know, very, very fine margins. There's a point where Tompkins is actually closer to Jesus than Ward. And I think there's a complete lack of coordination at that particular moment. I think everyone had switched off, and it wasn't an ideal situation, but there was no going back. Once Jesus changed direction, Tompkins couldn't get there. Ward was in the wrong place. That's how the goal happened. And, you know, it's incredibly frustrating and crushingly, you used the word inevitable earlier on, and it did feel like that. And it was really annoying, because actually I thought the plan was working up to then.
No, I agree with that part. I certainly don't agree with your first part, but I'm not surprised that you're defending Jeff. But, you know, that's what we're here for. We're here to disagree with each other as much as agree. So I'm fine with that, and we'll leave it where it is. Or we'll spend way too much time talking about it. Before we do talk about the real sucker punch of the second goal, lots of people, particularly on social media, whilst the game was going on, really furious with Wayne Hennessy because he was just standing still when the ball went in. So we won't talk fully about Wayne right now, because obviously, you know, lineup-wise, that's what a big headline that was. Vicente Guaita was injured and Wayne Hennessy returned to the fold, and lots of people reacted negatively just to that news. And obviously it was also Kelly was out and Tompkins came back, but other than that, same team, obviously allowing for the fact that McCarthy dropped out for Luca to come back in as well. But so I don't think you're welcome to disagree with me, but I'm going to say this right now. There is nothing that Wayne Hennessy is doing about that header. In fact, you could count him extremely unlucky for the fact that the ball has even touched the post. But, you know, two keepers aren't getting to that. It's from that angle. He's standing in the right place. If he dives, he doesn't get it. It's just unfortunate with the mentality and the attitude towards Wayne, which, you know, I'll be honest, I have myself. I don't rate him particularly highly as a goalkeeper at Premier League level. And just by the fact that he's just stood there, it just makes it easy to criticise him, you know, rather than a despairing dive and people might not do it. But, you know, I think that's very, very harsh. And if Guaita concedes a goal in that exact manner, nobody would say a word.
I mean, rather than talking about the dive for the header, it's only easy to tell in the half where that, you know, Hennessy's near us in the Homesdale, but it's his positioning in general for balls coming into the box. So would Guaita perhaps have been, you know, very much on top of Jesus at that point? It's a difficult one to talk about. The one other thing I would bring up is that The last time the Kelly Cahill axis was broken was when Saka came back into the side and we lost 4-0 against Tottenham. So I think we probably have to think the we have got in there a keeper that they're not used to playing with. I mean, Cahill won't have played with him in a professional game thus far. And another central defender. So the communication is not going to be quite as strong. So and Hennessy, I think in general, it just isn't as good with communication.
Like looking back at the goal, you can see that it was a low cross and there's nothing that Hennessy could do about it. And I feel like the same would have happened with Vicente as well. The cross was just in an awkward position, so I wouldn't blame the goalkeeper for it. And I mean, with the Hennessy blame for the goal, I'm not really surprised. As you said, Hambo, there's always going to be people that's against Hennessy. And it's feels like every time I speak about him, this always gets mentioned, but I feel like I need to say it again. There's no chance of Hennessy succeeding at Palace. I still don't understand why he's at the club, because there's a portion of the fan base that will never, regardless of how good he plays, never really trust him. So, I mean, it's weird from a club that we've still managed to keep him for this long. And every time a window comes up, I always wonder, is this the time where Hennessy is going to be sold? But for the benefit of him as well, because end of the day, footballers are humans and he also sees the comments that people say about him, and it's just not good for both sides.
Got to say on that, we came out slightly half cut out the glazes when the guy tucked us out, and Hennessy was surrounded by people trying to get selfies with him. So he still does have a bit of a fan base. Chris asked if I would go and get one with him. And I've always wondered whether he actually was that much taller than me. And he definitely is slightly taller than me. And when you're, I think it only makes sense to people that are sort of, you know, 6.5 foot tall. You sort of spot someone that's marginally taller than you and you can't tell if they are. And you both give each other this evil of like, are you, aren't you? Because it's so rare. He is a very, very tall man. But he did stay and took a photo with everyone until we came along and then he fucked off.
The thing you say about tall people, giving evil to other tall people, one of my best mates, my oldest friend actually, he's over 6'9". Wow. And he does that. And I swear to God, he's such a placid guy. But the second he spots someone taller than him, that's it. His mood goes. He can't think straight. He can't speak properly. It just gets to him. He hates it. Anyway,
it's a weird time. I saw someone taller than me, I can't handle it. So that's why I gauge my. Yeah. You get on my nerves. I feel like I should let out here. You blocked my view yesterday. That's why I had to go on the other side.
I thought you'd move because the guy that you were standing next to had a bit of a BA problem. I didn't realise it was because of me. Oh, sorry.
I couldn't see the game until I had to go next to Chris. Oh, all right. Let's talk about the second goal.
Yeah, why not? Why not? Brutal. So look, it's the classic sucker punch. You know, obviously from the kickoff, we go on the front foot, start pushing up there. Coyote running with the ball. Sorry, and you know, looking like we're going to threaten. Just a little interception, all of a sudden they just turn the tails on us, sprinting up. And I think this is where, again, we're doing hyper analysis here, we're getting, you know, incredibly critical, well, trying to effectively pick things that we could have done better. But, you know, in reality, breaks are what they are. We play like this, you know, we play on the break, you know, soak up pressure, sprint and catch people when they're out of position. So it's very, very hard in a short space of time to get everybody back where they should be and defending in unison. And that's what we wanted to do. And unfortunately, that's what we failed to do on this break. So I think there's a couple of key points. In the build-up, it was we did get actually back into shape relatively well. But obviously, we weren't going with players. We were going with spaces. So the players breaking had plenty of, you know, there was plenty of options for those on the ball. And that's the first part that makes it tricky. We possibly would have been okay as well because, you know, everybody was standing up, looking at the ball in the right positions. But unfortunately, PVA had dropped about 5 yards deeper than the rest of the back four, which made the run from David Silva in behind a little bit easier than it perhaps should have been to stay onside. I do think the run was timed so well that actually he would have been on anyway. But I think the final thing to mention is what a fantastic pass it was from Raheem Sterling. He didn't have the best of games, sort of refused to score goals to keep me from getting any fantasy football points. But he had an absolute blinder there in terms of that pass. And I think the final thing to say on it really is that obviously Wayne Hennessy will be disappointed to be beaten with a shot through the legs, but absolutely not culpable in that. It's as I said, very, very hard for anybody in our team to be criticised there because it was a break. We did our best to get back, and unfortunately the class of Man City sort of told in the end.
Yeah, 100% agree. And it really shows what would happen if we did go and open up against City. I mean, you see the talent that they have on a counter-attack. But I think unlike the first goal where we were looking at, oh, is it Joel Ward's fault? Is it Jeffrey Schlupp's fault? I think you just look at that goal and it's just quality. It's just they had the better quality. And I feel like we actually done pretty well, as you said, Hambo, in terms of getting back to our shape and actually trying to stop them. But that chip pass and, you know, your through and goal is just so easy. They make it look so easy and it just shows the difference between the two sides.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. You in? Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Right, so that's quite enough of that, but there's a couple more bits I do want to cover, if I may, in talking about the game, gents. And that, I suppose we better start with a couple of the key chances that we had, because obviously we were much better in the second half. We've obviously heard that a number of times before. And I suppose you sort of hinted at earlier, would that have been the case if it was still 0-0, or would we have seen perhaps a slightly less excitable start to the second half from a Palace perspective? What do you think, Chris?
I think definitely we would have seen a different and a more sedate start to the second half if we hadn't been behind. Because that, I mean, Roy always fine tunes at half time. We know that is the way that things are. You know, you can see the flaws in the game, but for whatever reason, he doesn't seem to be able to do that in game management on. Yeah, in kind of real time, it needs to be a team talk, and then the subs happen at 75 minutes, and that's pretty much the methodology. Interestingly, you know, that's not the case in this particular game, because as you said, Schlappi comes off earlier, and you know, there was more intensity in that second half performance. But I still think that, you know, it's more likely that, you know, we would have seen an improvement, just not quite the same level of step change as we did in this particular game.
I'd be really interested from any listener that knows these stats, that's really into their stats. I think we made a sub on 55 minutes. Whether there's been, how many subs there's been earlier than that are not due to an injury? Because I'm struggling to think of any. I think there was a few at half time a couple of seasons ago when we were sort of 1 or 2 nil down. I'm not sure there's been any others. And it was quite stunning. So that and the sort of 10-minute period we had where we were really pushing for stuff and the crowd was up to the second, I remember. The rest of it was just sort of...
Yeah, I guess so. I can't think of an earlier sub myself, I have to say. I do think you're right. There possibly have been some half-time subs in maybe some poor games. In the back of my mind, I'm thinking that might have been something in a cup game, but I'm not going to look it up now because we're recording a podcast, aren't we? So probably crack on with that, I reckon. But yeah, look, we had a couple of chances. There wasn't anything particularly significant. It wasn't one of those games where you look back and said, oh, you know, key moments there would have changed everything. It's certainly nothing of note first half. really at all. Start right at the start of the second half. This is possibly, you know, I was saying there weren't any pivotal moments, but this possibly was one when Koyate got through and had an opportunity to shoot and realistically should do better. He's kind of slashed at the ball a little bit and it's gone high and wide, but it's probably a better chance than that shot made it look. But great to see that intent. I don't think we, you know, for the reasons we've already discussed in depth, we could probably start the game off with that level of intent. But sometimes it does feel a little bit of a shame that we don't do it until we're losing matches. A little bit later on, we've already mentioned it in passing, but another chance that we had was from a PVA taking a corner this time. Luca had just gone off the pitch, been substituted for. Benteke comes on the pitch, great header, absolutely leap, incredible height on the leap. All of this is, you know, that's Benteke at his very, very best, is when he's leaping a foot higher than everyone else and powering a header at goal. Absolutely sensational save from Edison to push it onto the bar. And it really is just his luck that he gets that moment and then no other crosses for the rest of the game, the entire time he's on the pitch. But yeah, incredibly unlucky and a fantastic effort in my view.
I was thinking about this during the game and even before the game, to be fair. You look at City's lineup and they didn't have any central defenders. They had midfielders playing in defence. I mean, Roy wouldn't have guessed this beforehand because they don't usually do this. They do play with actual centre-backs. But let's say if Benteke started the game, do you think that he would have... I wouldn't say he would have been better, but would he have offered something different? Because as soon as Benteke came on, I don't know if you guys realised, Pep made a change and put on John Stones as well to actually counter that. And one of the players that who hasn't performed so far this season has been John Stones. So it would have made... Basically, Pep played someone who isn't on form and it would have offered something different.
I think you make a really good point there, Dale. And in asking the question, Pep answered that question effectively before the game even started, because in his pre-match interview, he talked about the fact that Benteke would come on the pitch later on. He talked about the fact he had no centre-backs, and he said, you know, when Benteke comes on later on, it might be a problem. And it's just like, you know, we talk about our predictability, and that's really where it is. He already knew, once obviously the lineup was announced, that Benteke would be coming on later on, and he already had that change in mind. I'm absolutely certain of it, because he effectively said he had. But in questioning whether or not Benteke should have started, you know, the question really becomes, does Ayew deserve to be dropped? And the answer to that has to be no, because he's been great for us. But in reality, if you know that the opposition is, you know, short centre-backs, you really want to test them as much as humanly possible. If there's any weakness in your opponent, you target it. And I'm not sure how much of a difference it would have made, but part of me agrees and has that same sort of wondering in my mind of what if we had taken that chance. And you don't necessarily have to drop Ayew. You could change the system and play Benteke and Ayew if you like. But if we had maybe just put them under pressure, gone a bit more direct straight off, could have got something different happen. But it's very, very difficult. They're still a class team and they still had so many attackers on the pitch that could take us apart at any moment. I don't think it's that big of an issue. But good question anyway. The only other chance of note that sort of comes to mind was late on when Zaha forced another good save out of Edison. Just basically picked up a loose ball, went to the right-hand side of the area, driving towards goal, shoots across, good save. And Ayew, a little bit of a poor effort, shall we say, on the follow-up, but a very, very tight angle for him to actually score. But, you know, he has his head in his hands and seems a little bit disappointed. So, you know, maybe too late really to impact the game, but maybe could have got something there too.
Is that the same chance where Wilf does get tripped as he's going into the box and could arguably have dived for a penalty and chose not to and carried on? I think it is, isn't it?
Yeah, there's definitely a bit of contact there, but... But, you know, or maybe there wasn't, because, you know, we all know Wolf's a terrible diver, isn't he? So, you know, obviously would have fallen down if there was contact. Yeah. No, it's, I'd say, but I think he, you know, obviously showed his intent as well there, but a good save. Talking of good saves, there were three key saves from Hennessy and a number of other saves, but the three I picked out. First half, brilliant tip over from a Bernardo Silva shot. I mean, that is a top save to get I think he was sort of diving over, so his left hand just tips it over and wide. Brilliant, brilliant save. Fantastic save to the right from Jesus. Again, pushing it wide brilliantly. And that's something he's not always done when making saves. Sometimes gets his hand to it, sort of doesn't really divert it out of the way, but really good, strong right hand to it, pushed it around the post. And another follow-up save later on from Jesus, who really should have squared it to De Bruyne for a tap-in. But really good positioning, stood up really well for the challenge. Obviously, we talked about the goals he conceded, but this kind of leads us into the man of the match discussion. And I can't, in terms of top performers, I think for me, Wayne probably gets man of the match. As I say, I'm not his biggest fan as a goalkeeper in terms of ability. But in terms of that performance from a second choice goalkeeper, you've got to respect it. He did extremely well, and if Guaita's out for a long period, arguably that's a positive.
I'd probably go with Jimmy Mack myself. I thought Hennessy did well, but at times his distribution was poor. I think we've come to get used to slightly better distribution than he offered. You could see a couple of times visible frustration from the players. I think one of them was a ball out to PVA when he was on the break, ballooned over him out into touch, and he was pretty pissed off. Jimmy Mack just seemed to have another game in front of the defence where he dominated. So it was a bit of a toss-up for me between the two of them, but I'd have given it to the short Scotsman.
I'd go for Hennessy, and the reason I'd go for Hennessy is because he really hasn't had a lot of game time in quite a while since Guaita arrived. And while it wasn't the best performance, it was a solid performance. And in a game like this, when you're playing one of the two best teams in the country, you've got to have a keeper who's absolutely on it. And he's not at fault for either of the goals, fundamentally. So, for me, yeah, easy, Hennessy.
Oh, I'll have to go with Scott Dan. No, I'm joking. I'll have to go with Wayne Hennessy as well. I mean, look, in the first half, I wasn't comfortable with him being in goal because there were times, even though he wasn't really at fault with the goals, but there were times where crosses were going into the box and he wasn't using his height to an advantage and he was just flapping the crosses. But in the second half, as the game went on, he looked more comfortable and made some good saves. Vicente is still my number one. I feel like when Vicente doesn't play, our chance of winning the game reduces massively because he's that much of a quality goalkeeper. But Hennessy, as a second choice goalkeeper, I thought he'd done a decent job overall.
Well, there we have it. I think, MacArthur was probably the pick of the outfield players. I'll agree with that. I thought Cahill, again, strong game. A few people sort of questioning Wilf. I think it's important to remember he's had a couple of long trips to play international football as well. He did seem a little bit short of his usual frenetic pace. And I think the thing sticking in most people's minds, as mentioned earlier, was being outpaced by Fernandinho. And I just think that's a situation where he's looked at the space he's got, he's looked at the pass, and he's thought he's easily going to get there. And he hasn't counted on the fact that Fernandinho is going to go absolutely insane running faster than he's probably ever run in his life. And he's just, unfortunately not quite been at the races there. I thought Coyote...
Look, with Wilfried Zaha quickly, these are the games that he should step up in if he wants that big move. And I found it a bit disappointing. I feel like as the game went on, there was an incident as well. He started the game off well in terms of tracking back and helping Woody. But as the game went on, he just seemed to lose focus. I don't know if it was the tiredness factor. As you said, he was on international duty as well. But he got the Sterling, ran all the way up the pitch and tackled Zaha. And then Zaha was on the floor and he was just jogging back. And if City done that switch to the right-hand side, Woody was going to be so isolated and was going to be in deep trouble. So situations like that, in terms of effort, I didn't see him putting in the effort for the whole 90 minutes. And I was a bit disappointed because the game's on TV and you have to step up if you want to prove yourself as that big player, because skill plays to a certain part, but players and other teams, are especially big clubs, they're going to look at your attitude, and it just didn't seem like it was there against City.
Again, I think we're getting a little bit into microanalysis again, because obviously he's just hurtled all the way up the pitch. So for him to then turn around and hurtle all the way back again, I see what you mean, and you can look at it in that way. I do think it's also worth noting that there was a couple of tactical shifts, both swapping sides with Jeffrey Schlupp, and then there was a shift to have him playing more centrally for a period of time as well. I think sometimes it's difficult to keep track of that, to realise, when you're looking, why isn't Wilf tracking back? It's actually because he's moved positions and he's no longer supposed to be tracking back. But I think, he's a player who, because of his circumstances, people will be looking closely for any perceived sign of him not giving everything. But you're absolutely right. He's a human, and he is susceptible to being frustrated and also for having poor games. I don't think he had a poor game. I think he had a reasonable game. But in terms of what you're saying, Dale, you're absolutely right. In terms of getting a big move, he's got to shine pretty much every match. We know he's that good. We really do. But as I say, he's a human being. So let's talk a tiny little bit, not as much time as it perhaps deserves, but Joel Ward made his 200th league appearance prior to the match, and there was a tribute at the game, a fantastic tribute at the game to Joel Ward. It looked absolutely incredible seeing it back, and a fitting tribute. Mike, obviously you are a massive Joel Ward fan, and in any way you can praise him, you will. But I think, in this day and age, 200 league games for Palace, lots of those at Premier League level. In fact, I think he's got the highest Premier League appearances for Palace. And this season, despite, I had reservations, and he does, in my view, have limitations, he's actually got better and better as the season's gone on, I think.
I feel like he has. I know the Wolves thing sticks in people's minds, the goal, but he's been as solid as you can expect from a right back. I was in the Kronk's bar before the game, thus missing the thing I've seen photos of since. I need to definitely get into the ground and get my seat earlier. A, to stop people nicking it, and B, to help out with these things. You're talking about 400 grand for 200 appearances. My maths is poor, but that's 2 grand. That's 2 grand per appearance for that transfer fee. And I would say that you will not find much better value than that. You can't fault him for his effort yesterday. There was a couple of balls over. Their crosses tended to hang a little bit long, a few of them. And he was excellent with his coverage, heading stuff off the corners, that kind of thing. I really don't think you could have asked much more of a man that last season was by far the second choice right back.
Indeed. And in the interest of time, both DR and Chris like him too. Let's move on. So that's the game covered. Let's have a little chat about Luka. Lots of discussions. I got into a bit of a debate on Twitter earlier on today, started by Nicholas Gillard. A variety of views, and I think I'm very much going to nail my colours to the mast on this one. So we're talking about Luka Milivojevic and whether or not we're a better team with him in it or him not in it. And there's lots of different angles to this, but the sort of suggestion was, starting from Nick, that Luka gives the ball away too much, particularly in key areas, and that, he doesn't, it's about time he got dropped because he's not really performing, all this kind of stuff. And a few people agree and a few people disagree. And I strongly disagree personally, because I think it's definitely a perception issue. And I suppose in one way I'd say the first thing that happens on the match of the day highlights, looking back at those, is that you see Luka give the ball away. I think partly that sticks in people's minds when they're watching things back. I think you will always notice someone misplacing a pass in a critical position. So I thought I'd dig out the stats in terms of pass percentage completion, I think, as well as looking quite closely at number of passes per game on average. So Luka, in terms of the central midfielders, he is, I got it in front of me, can you tell? But I was just trying to sort it and it hasn't sorted properly. So what do we think is happening there?
You're doing a good job so far. Continue waffling.
Thanks, mate. Thanks.
Yeah.
But That's annoying. It was sorted earlier on. What do I do?
Did I chip it?
What do you think? Why not? While I'm trying to figure.
I don't know if you guys remember what I said last week about how many games he's played without taking a single minute off. And yesterday you saw it by Roy Hodgson actually subbing him off. And I don't remember the last time he's done that with Luka Milivojevic. So, I mean, that's a positive. And I just think Luka deserves I don't think he should be dropped. Someone said it on Twitter as well. That phrase is wrong. I think he deserves like a rest for a couple of games. Just like Andros has done. And it's worked out well for him. You know, Andros had the start of the season. He wasn't great. He was dropped for a bit. And then coming off the bench, he's actually impacted the game in a positive way. So maybe him sitting down for a couple of games or coming off the bench, it might not harm. And also, it's hard when people are comparing Luka Milivojevic and McCarthy and saying who's better. I mean, Luka's been at the club for how many years now? McCarthy's only had one start. So it's hard to say who's better. But McCarthy seemed like he could put in a decent shift. He's proved that against West Ham. So maybe playing McCarthy in place of him. And the next couple of games against top teams. So I wouldn't play Camaras or Maya in place of him. But so if you play McCarthy in place of him, and if it doesn't work, bring Luka off the bench.
It's a tough one, isn't it? Because I'm not sure that McCarthy or anyone plays quite the same role as Milivojevic. So it's a difficult one. We've got a few comments on Twitter about... We've got a lot of comments on Twitter about this. Nick Gillard had posted about him, and it's a divisive topic. A lot of people... Well, he initially said, I think we're better without Luka. And he's probably... tongue-in-cheek there a little bit. A lot of people just replied with no. Rob 2 said, yep, need some time on the naughty step, which as a dad with young kids, I can relate to. More and more people saying no. Ebo, he's certainly out of form at the moment and gets caught in possession a lot. Think he and Kouyaté are doing the same thing, and I'd probably say Kouyaté does it better. Interesting. It makes me wonder whether we do quite know what Luka does, or whether... A bit like Kabay back a couple of seasons ago, we'll only know when he's not there. Craig Skinner said, I actually thought about this myself yesterday. What does he bring to the team, penalties aside? So, I mean, I think possibly it's the fact that we are not capable of quite sometimes seeing the stuff that these players do.
I think that's a really important point. Look, you know, he does a specific role in screening the back four. When people talk about him maybe not doing that as well as he might, you know, quite often he's the only one doing that role. So it's not actually that easy to do, particularly when you look at games like the Man City game. For people to suggest that McCarthy is a better option because of one game where we played West Ham, I don't think is fair either. I really like McCarthy as a player. I do. I think he's a very talented player and can be slightly aggrieved that he got dropped. But, you know, I think where people kind of miss the point, look, Luka plays the most passes in terms of average passes per game of anyone in our whole squad as of this season. 41, I think, 46, I think Cahill's the nearest challenger on 40, just under 41, right? So he plays a huge number of passes. So therefore, even with a decent pass percentage, he's still giving away the ball more often than most other people because he's got the ball more often than most other people. So he plays an absolutely pivotal role in linking play. So, I mean, Nick even came back with the thing, saying, oh, well, how many of those passes were forwards? Well, that's not what he's there to do. He's there to win the ball back, close down space, and set other attacks going. I don't think anyone in our team does that better than Luka. Now, if you want to talk to me about does anyone take a better set of pieces than Luka, I might have a different view on that. If you want to talk to me about is he the best captain for the club, currently I don't think there's any reason to change that. But you know, you would argue if Gary Cahill perhaps had more service, he'd perhaps be a stronger option. But I don't see any reason to change the captaincy. But set pieces, I can see the point there.
The real thing about this, I mean, I almost don't understand why we're talking about it, but I suppose it's come up and it's created a lot of debate. So here we go. Here's my two, Penneth. I think Luka, as you say, Chris, he links up play in a really important way. A lot of what he does is necessarily negative, in that it's about destroying what the opposition want to do. And you will only ever notice that when there's someone else who's not doing that as well as he is doing it. That's part one. The second is just that, naturally, he plays a linchpin metronomic role in terms of moving the ball from, unless Wayne Hennessy or Guaita is kicking the ball long, then he's the natural player to collect the ball from the centre-backs and then push it out to the sides, whichever side that is. And that's a really important role just in moving the ball forward. So, I don't think it's necessarily just a question, as per Nick's comment of, how many of those passes were forwards. Actually, frankly, they mostly are sideways, and that's the right thing to do because he's run forward with the ball. Just seems really obvious to me, but, I guess that's the point.
Yeah, typically there's the sort function on the stats is now working, but we're pretty much done. But you're absolutely right, Chris. Interestingly, the pass percentage highest in the who would you reckon is the top of the table in terms of pass percentages?
Guaita. Oh.
Silence.
Camarasta.
It's actually Victor Camarasta. Yeah, with an entire three passes, all successful.
Yeah.
5 minutes. This is for in the Premier League, by the way. So three passes, all 100% successful in his 5 minutes of play. But Luka's the highest accuracy percentage of all the central midfielders. He's also, as I said earlier, the highest number of passes. He's the highest in terms of key passes. Every way possible, pass-wise, he does the most. Crosses, I mean, yes, that's hugely impacted by the fact that he takes the set pieces. Like I say, and I think that's something that's up for debate. There was a free kick in the first half against City that actually landed at the feet of James McArthur in the box, but it was clearly aimed for the back post because that's what everyone was talking about, and he completely mishit it, mishit a standing ball. So I think delivery wise there's something to be said there, but he does so much better work. And I really don't get what he did against City to even warrant this discussion, as you're kind of saying, Chris. It's like, other than that one moment where he gave the ball away early in the first half, I think there were so many other times where he stepped out. And the thing that you remembered earlier on, Mike, when you were talking about the sort of first-time hooked pass, that was actually Luka playing that across the pitch rather than Joel Ward. He's top player, but another one of those in the long line of players who, as you're suggesting, don't get appreciated until they're not in the team and not around. And also telling that Nick, who started this debate, also wrote off Mile Jedinak long before he was ready to come out of the team, arguably if he ever was ready to come out of the team. But there we go. I think that's probably enough to leave that there.
Quickly, who had the most shots on target? Guess. Oh, no. Oh, don't worry. It flopped. I thought it was Benteke. It wasn't Benteke. Sorry. End the show.
Well, who was it then? Wilf?
Actually, it might be Benteke. Wait, who had the most? Because I didn't have a shot on target. Wilf had one as well. Oh, it's a tight one. Who had most shots on target? Wolf has had one shot on target.
Can we stick to making comments based on actual statistics rather than guessing stuff?
It is statistics, Wolf has had one. Yeah, it is Wolf and Benteke.
Yeah, I say, without looking it up, I can remember two shots on target in the whole game, and I know who took them because we've talked about them. So, yeah, one each. Thanks for that, DR. Important interjection right at the end there. Vital work. You love to see it. There was one comment in that we were going to talk about, and that's from Michael Chewy, who's said, it's the same question that's come up a few times. Are we avoiding playing Camarasa so we aren't forced to pay the money for his appearance clause? No, we're not. Move on. And other than that, I think that's more than enough for you this week. So thank you very much indeed for listening. Do share and subscribe this podcast on your favourite podcast app. Rate us 5 stars. DR will be back with others on the Love Sports Show Tuesday, 8 till 9 p.m. And obviously don't forget the preview show later in the week. Probably hit you around Wednesday/Thursday night. where Terence, Sam, and I think Albert's on holiday now, isn't he? So someone else will be representing.
Yeah, it's me, I think.
Oh, bloody hell. Well, there you go.
Sorry, people.
Double dose of Mike. What a week it's going to be. Double DR and double Mike. Impressive stuff. Anyway.
Biggie.
Thank you very much.
Mashy.
What? Yeah. Right. Everyone other than DR on the panel, thanks for joining me. DR, shut up. Cheers to Mikey for producing. We'll be back next week. Bye.
Fintons.
It's the 90th minute. All your mates around. You've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Your mate's already got booked for double dipping, and you steal the last nugget, snatching all 3 points. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. You in? At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee, and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network.
TalkSport. Powered by fans.